My deep appreciation of theater history was instilled in me by Tom Empey, a college mentor to me and hundreds of others. While teaching Greek theater terms, he would grab the fabric of his slacks and say, "You see these pants? Euripides, Eumenides," making light of content that could be considered rather dry and stuffy while still maintaining respect for the art, which is what I want to do with this podcast. For each episode, I invite a guest from the many paths my theater career has taken me down. I give my guest no idea what we'll be talking about, but they know we're going to find an outrageous story about theater history and perhaps get a better understanding about why we're still doing it after all these years. So welcome to Euripides Eumenides, and I am your host, Aaron Odom. Apocalypse, I said, why you wanna show up now? Just when the heart of my life was getting good. I'll give you one more chance. Walk on out of the door, yeah. Get your ass to getting where the getting is good. Good morrow, Eumenidites. This is Aaron Odom from Trident Theater, bringing you another episode of Euripides Eumenides, a theater history podcast. I want to jump right into this episode because it is a continuation of the previous episode about Arthur Miller's classic introspective play, Death of a Salesman, and the several actors who have played Willie Loman on Broadway. Now, before I get into that, I do want to let you know that I could have gone somewhat deeper into this and described what methods were taken by each actor to create their own personal versions of Willie Loman. However, having been in the business for quite some time and knowing how personally some actors and acting teachers feel about their preferred acting methods, and for this instance, method is spelled with a lowercase m here, I don't want to suggest that one method is more superior than another when creating a role. I have my opinions, and I have shared them on the show several times, but for this episode, when comparing different productions, I felt it necessary to look at it more from a perspective of critical reaction. Granted, I don't always see eye to eye with critics, and sometimes I know that critics can be just as biased as those who prefer one school of acting over another. But frankly, in my opinion, the role of the critic is essential in that it creates an official record of the progression of the art of theater, while also needing to be self-effacing enough to understand when the critic is behind the times as well and needs to adapt to the new thing that's coming along. Okay, was that enough of an editorial for you? So let's get down to business. If you haven't listened to the last episode, it's not entirely essential to fully understand this episode, but there are some things you may have missed. So if you want the full experience, go back and check that one out before playing this one. But if you want to just go ahead and get on with this one, I'll give you a play-by-play. My guest and I first discussed the basic premise of Death of a Salesman as the taste test for the success of the American dream. Is it working for everyone? Short answer, no. We see this through the plight of Willie Loman, a traveling salesman who in his early 60s in 1949 is starting to realize that his entire life of work may not have led to the fulfillment of the American dream. Then, my guest and I began to discuss the several actors who have played Willie in the biggest commercial theater market in the world, Broadway. In 1949, the role was originated by Lee J. Cobb, much to the chagrin of playwright Arthur Miller. Miller originally wanted Willie to be played by a much smaller actor to emphasize the metaphor of a small man slowly being crushed by the weight of responsibility. Lee J. Cobb, a big guy, did the job better than most other smaller actors at the time. So Arthur Miller and director Elia Kazan affectionately referred to Cobb as a walrus due to his, quote, lugubrious movements as Willie. All references to Willie being a shrimp in the original script were changed to Willie being a walrus. Cool. Thus, with this production, the American theater audience had an idea of what Willie Loman should be, a broad-shouldered man being slowly worn down by a dream he can't achieve and can't comprehend why. The next production we talked about was in 1975, when Patton star George C. Scott played Willie. In reviews, it sounded as though Scott's portrayal did not make the audience sympathize with the character as much as seeing him as a desperate creature that at times could almost be despised. And that's as far as we've gotten. Six actors have played Willie Loman on Broadway, and we have four left to cover. My guest for these episodes was Tracy Burns, who teaches acting for animators at the California College of the Arts in San Francisco. Tracy details that role really well in the previous episode, so if you want to understand what that's all about, go back and check that one out. But After speaking about Willie Loman for so long, Tracy had a performance in mind that was pretty much the Willie Loman for her. And we talk about that right away in this episode. But Tracy also had a great question about how do we make Willie's plight seem more relevant in a post-COVID world? We get into that as well. So, enough prep. Let's get into today's episode, Death of a Salesman and Playing Willie Loman on Broadway, Part 2. Well, speaking of ringing bells, I think we're getting to the one you have been alluding to here. And this is 1984, Dustin Hoffman.
Yes.
Oh, I love this version. I really do. In college, somebody told me, and I don't know why this number stuck in my head, and I have not been able to corroborate it in any of my studies, but I'm going to say it's absolute God's honest truth. Somebody told me that for the entire production, he was making something like $84,000 a week.
Wow.
And I'm like, it might have been a month. I don't know. But still, I'm like, oh my God. Wow. That's so much money.
Yeah.
In 1984.
Yeah. Oh my God. Wow. Mm-hmm. In theater. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. But of course, as you've been kind of alluding to, Hoffman's size was the biggest shock of this production.
Yeah.
He's a little guy. I mean, what, Hoffman's like 5'5 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So he's meeting Miller's original intent of having Willie be something smaller. And of course, all the references of walrus were actually changed back to shrimp.
There you go. How did they take it? Was it a shock? Because did people, or I mean, Dustin Hoffman was at his height. So
yeah.
I'm sure people were just thrilled to see it.
Yeah. And so this isn't even 10 years after the last production on Broadway, which is kind of interesting.
Right.
But this production focused a lot more on the theme of fathers and sons, you know? I mean, the whole idea of the American dream at the beginning of the Reagan 80s was like, we're okay. We're really okay, you know? So they focused a lot more on the father and son theme, and there was plenty to chew on in this play. But surrounding Willie in some cool roles were John Malkovich as Willie's older son, Biff. And that was his Broadway debut, John Malkovich. And the other son, Happy, was played by Stephen Lang. And listeners may know Stephen Lang as the main bad guy, Quaritch, in the James Cameron Avatar movies.
Oh, okay.
The big, burly military guy.
Okay. Yeah. I think I know him by sight, but the name's not ringing a bell.
Right.
Malkovich. Interesting.
Yeah, with all of his hair.
Yeah.
I mean, he had hair like Conan O'Brien at that point.
It was really, okay. Yeah, yeah. Not a Malkovich
fan. No. Yeah. He's an acquired taste. And Hoffman had just been seen in Tootsie the year before, but was already been one of America's favorite actors for like the last 15 years. Like nobody expected him to explode. I read some story as I was researching this in a production of Miller's View from the Bridge that had both Robert Duvall and John Voight. The director says somebody in this room is going to play Willie Loman at some point in the next 20 years. And he scans around the room and he passes over Robert Duvall and he passes over John Voight and he points to the little stage manager who's, you know, got his earphones on and he's just writing on paper, and it's Dustin Hoffman.
Oh wow.
It's like, wow. That's the guy that understands this part.
Wow, fascinating.
Isn't that neat?
Yeah.
But yeah, like I said, it was the difference between the size and heft of both Lee J. Cobb and George C. Scott and Dustin Hoffman with his smaller, wilier, more electric performance that drew headlines. You know, I mean, in almost anything I've seen, he's just explosive and electric with his movements. You know, that's just who Dustin Hoffman is. And it wasn't really a reimagining for Miller, but it was for the American theater audience. And plus, Hoffman was a lot younger than Willie. Hoffman played Willie at 41.
Well, that's what I was. I think that's probably why I was surprised that Willie's in his 60s, because I'm remembering the Hoffman version, and he was a lot younger, which means you'd have to, well, no, then that's interesting that Malkovich, that they're not younger.
No. But this is actually really interesting. If people are going to say Hoffman's was weird because he was 41, then you have to completely discredit his predecessors, because Cobb originated the role at age 37.
Did they age him up, though? Did they do the old age makeup?
Well, I mean, you saw the picture.
Yeah,
I
said, he looks older. He does not look 37.
He does not look 63 either.
No.
I think they did age him up. At least they did for the movie version. His hair looks pretty powdered. And George C. Scott was a little closer when he first played him at 48 in 1975.
He's 48 now. He looks 63.
Yep. Here. I'll get you the picture of Dustin Hoffman that I got. That is so fascinating. I love this. Because the picture I got is... I swear to God, the actor in that scene opposite him is like 7 feet tall.
Yeah, no kidding.
So really emphasizing, you're a little man.
You're tiny. You're a tiny guy.
Yep. But besides having a hard time accepting that the very alive Willie that Hoffman played was in his early 60s, here are some comments from Frank Rich's review in the New York Times that I feel perfectly sum up Hoffman's performance of Willie. I mean, I've seen this one. It was the TV movie that they did. I love it. Here's a quote. As Willie Loman in Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman, Dustin Hoffman doesn't trudge heavily to the grave. He sprints. His fist is raised and his face is cocked defiantly upwards so that his rimless spectacles glint in the Brooklyn moonlight. Here, continuing on. As Mr. Hoffman stumbles through the shadowy recollections of his past, trying to both deny and transmute the awful truth of an impoverished existence, he lurches and bobs like a strand of broken straw tossed by a mean wind.
Oh, interesting.
That's such a poetic line.
Yeah.
But here's the last one from this review that I love. Mr. Hoffman's Willie is a total break from the mountainous Lee J. Cobb image. He's a trim, immaculately outfitted go-getter in a three-piece suit, replete with the bright matching tie and handkerchief. Is there anything sadder than a nobody dressed for success or an old man masquerading as his younger self? Ooh.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. I'm curious. Yeah, there's something in me that's going, but did Hoffman let himself go to the place that George C. Scott went?
Yeah, right.
If he's wearing all that and he really goes to the desperate, begging, pleading, groveling place while wearing that three-piece suit, then that would be interesting. But is there some vanity going on? I'd be curious. I don't remember it well enough.
I'm thinking back on it, Tracy, and now that you're saying that, his moments where he is really alive, you know, the hope is there. And we're all going to come out okay, kid, and slapping people in the backs and saying, you're going to go out there and kill him. The flip side of that coin is it's not the same value. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It does feel like, I mean, he does get low. He does just get kind of and kind of droopy, but it's not like, well, I think there's only one way out of this, which
that's what I mean by the journey. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that's a great place to start the journey, but that journey's got that has to drop.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It has to go somewhere that's painful, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Otherwise it's just kind of staying sort of on the surface. Yeah. And again, I don't remember it well enough to weigh in on what I thought of the performance, but something in me is kind of going, did he go there? Did he go there?
Yeah. And I don't think it's one of the more celebrated productions of it, even though it's like, hey, it's still a film production. We got a couple great performances out of it. And they've more focused. One of the reviews that I saw talked about how much they stretched explored the theme of fathers and sons. And when Biff finally forgives his father and leans in for a hug and puts his head on Willie's chest. So he must be sitting. Somebody said you could see the entire audience lean forward to try to be part of that embrace. I'm like, that's sweet. So is Willie's problem a big deal? I don't know. But these guys figured out what to go. So at the end, you're like, oh, well, okay. I guess that happened.
Yeah. Now I want to see it again. I want to see George C. Scott's version.
I wouldn't mind seeing that. Yeah. Now, here's the one that I am a lot more familiar with because I've actually seen this one live. Brian Dennehy, 1999.
Okay.
Yeah. This was the 50th anniversary production opening at the Eugene O'Neill Theater on February 10th, 1999, 50 years to the day of the opening original production. I thought that was so great. Nice. But I saw this when it went on tour when I was at college in Pepperdine, and it was at the Amundsen. And so I was only able to afford like nosebleed seats. But at intermission, this is a great thing about the Amundsen, lots of people leave. And so you can just squirrel your way down to, I think the people I went with, we were like 10 rows from the front.
Oh, great. Yeah. LA.
Yes. Yeah.
Stupid LA, right? Oh, I got to beat traffic.
What? I mean, I get the gist.
Anyway, go ahead.
Tracy, this man was enormous. Like, and I'm not talking like, you know, Brian Dennehy, he was a big guy, obviously. But I mean, he was so larger than life on that stage and so like explosive. And you're like, I want to be your best friend or son. Just tell me which one you have available and I am there. Like just a guy that comes into the room and says, what are you up to? And you tell him, this is what I'm doing. He's like, that sounds great. You're going to kill it out there, kid. And you just like, man, I like you. I like you a lot. But, you know, I mean, his opening scene is when he comes home from not being able to drive the drive that he needed to that night. He's like, I couldn't make it. The car kept going off the road. And, yeah, I don't know. You're like, oh, man, that. So you can see like this, the beginning of this downfall and a realization like, well, the end is coming, but no, I'm going to deny it. Woo! Sally Ford.
That, yeah. And that had to be such a painful thing to watch because you do really like this guy. So it's an interesting thing of the how painful it is to watch this guy that you like versus George C. Scott of I don't like this guy, but I can't take my eyes off of him or whatever the thing is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of how. Yeah. Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
And the woman they cast as his wife, Elizabeth Franz, she was the one who I was more impressed with out of it than, well, I mean, obviously Brian Dennehy. But her attention must be paid monologue was just tear jerking because it was a woman who sees her husband declining and realizing she's in a position that the only support she can give him is, you know, the best she's already doing. She can't go out and get another job. She can't really help. This is what she can do. She can be the support system and tell him he's doing everything right. And you're like, oh. That's even more tragic than Willie, in a way.
Yeah, standing by not being able to do anything.
Yeah. And you know, he was like 6'2". She was like 5'3". So when he would hug her to him, like her head was in his armpit. And, and it was such a big, huge visual image of him like scooping up his entire family in his arms. And you're like, oh, you're going to do it. I bet the end of the play is going to be different in your hands. But
yeah, I worked with his daughter on something. Oh, wow. I don't remember what it was. I just remember that we had a good time. Anyway.
Well, this is kind of interesting because Dennehy was the only actor on Broadway who played age-appropriate Willie. He was 61 when he played Willie. So you actually got it. You saw that age.
Do you have a picture of that?
Oh, yeah. Let me send that to you.
I'm liking these pictures. It's fun.
Okay. Where is he? Here he is. Oh, such a great image. This is what I'm talking about. Like this is him and his two, his two sons talking about what they're doing. And I think the boys are even lying to him about what's going on in their lives. Just
who are those actors? Do you know?
I can't remember, but when I saw it in LA, Biff was Ron Eldard, who he was on, I want to say like a procedural or a medical or, you know, like a fire drama or something like that. I can't remember.
Eldard?
A cop show. Yeah, Eldard, Ron Eldard.
There he is. Oh, yeah, that guy.
And he was phenomenal as Biff, too. But, I mean, to look at Brian Dennehy there at the kitchen table with his two sons, just like, yep, he's in control. And here's, I love this review. Dennehy reigns over it all. He roams a range from invincible confidence to punishing ignominy. He's fired by an extinguishable anger. His quiet moments are only distractions from unpredictable outbursts. There are even one or two moments when Willie's blowhard sallies are reminiscent of Ralph Cramden's outbursts at Alice. This goes to show there is often only the thinnest line between tragedy and comedy.
Yeah, nice.
Oh, man. And that, I'll tell you what, that was one thing that there was one lesson I got in an acting class in college where, you know, they put two very opposite emotions, you know, let's say we have love and we have hate, and they're just represented by lines on a chalkboard. And then he put another line right in between it and said, you cannot cross this line. You have to go all the way around it. And he drew a whole circle that goes from love to hate in a complete circular motion. Mm. And I'm like, that has stuck with me so hard. So this idea of the thin line between tragedy and comedy, and if Dennehy is going from this to this so quickly, he's going through that entire range of emotions in an instant, which I'm like, my God, if he wasn't exhausted at the end of every single night.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's always a transition. There's always a transition
from
emotion to emotion, even if it's split second. So yeah, that's a great, what a great exercise. What a great visual.
Yeah, isn't that neat?
Yeah, yeah, I like that a lot.
Well, you've heard mine, you've heard Tracy's, but you have two more to go. So far, do you have a Willie Loman you prefer over the others? It's my understanding that after the original 1949 production, this play has been adapted into multiple languages and has been presented all over the world. So I guess it's not just a feeling in America, is it? But while we're stopped, I'll remind you that if you're enjoying the show, I'd love for you to share it with your friends or on social media, or give the show a rating or write a review wherever you get your podcasts. It truly helps the show out. But let's get back to the show. Joining Tracy Burns again, we'll hear about the last two actors who played Willie Loman on Broadway. Okay, we got two more here. 2012, Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Right.
And yeah, this one didn't make a huge splash, and we'll talk about it here in a bit, but what an interesting choice, because it was just after he'd won his Oscar and just a couple years before he took his life.
Yeah.
This was directed by Mike Nichols.
Interesting.
Like in his 80s.
Wow.
And he credited Miller's play as the play that made him interested in theater.
Oh, fantastic.
So he's like, this is the play I want to do. I want to do this. But it's kind of, I don't know how I feel about this. Like, I thought about this earlier. They used the original set design and the original score from the 1949 production, which has been used many times because it was pretty iconic at the time. But I don't know. It reminds me a lot of when Gus Van Sant came out of the woodwork and said, you know what? I want to remake Psycho. You're rolling your eyes and shaking your
didn't.
Head. And didn't.
And then I'm going to do shot by shot. And then, no, you didn't.
Yeah, no, you didn't.
You did this whole thing where you said we're doing a shot by every shot. And it's like, that's not the shot. No, you didn't. So don't sell it. Because you didn't.
No,
you did it close enough that it just made it annoying, and far enough that it made it even more annoying.
Yeah. And you colorized it.
And you colorized it.
Stop that.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
So I don't know if that's, I would credit Mike Nichols as being a little bit more intuitive than Gus Van Sant and his Psycho.
Yeah. I mean, it would be interesting to bring back this set. I mean, it sounds like it could be cool. I have no idea.
Yeah. 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 Philip Seymour Hoffman discussed his interest in doing the part in an interview. He said this: Salesman really seeps into why we're here. What are we doing? Family, work, friends, hopes, dreams, careers. What's happiness? What's success? What does it mean? Is it important? How do you get it? And here, I'll send you his picture. It's a stark picture.
Mm.
I mean, just kind of sitting like almost looking to the heavens and going, why me? You know, but he does that kind of character so well, just somebody who's, you know, been placed in a situation out of his control and he doesn't know how to do anything with it.
Yeah. I'm curious what the journey, what the emotional journey was for Willie and his Willie. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you that in just a moment, but here's a fun fact that about this production that we probably got out of it for the better. This production also gave us a fantastic Broadway debut. Andrew Garfield in the role of Biff.
Oh, wow.
I would have loved to have seen that.
Oh, yeah. I love Andrew Garfield.
Yeah. And then he came back just a couple of years ago and did that amazing Angels in America. My God.
Oh.
But here's the Ben Brantley review. And if you impress Ben Brantley, you're awesome. If not, he writes one of these beauties. Uh-oh. That, yeah. Mind you, there are instances of piercing emotional conviction throughout, moments you want to file and rerun in memory. Mr. Hoffman does terminal uncertainty better than practically anyone, and he's terrific in showing the doubt that crumples Willie just when he's trying to sell his own brand of all-American optimism. What he doesn't give us is the illusion of the younger Willie's certainty of the belief in false gods. For Salesman to work as a tragedy, for which it does qualify, there has to be a touch of the Titan in Willie, of the hope-inflated man that his sons once worshipped, so we feel an ache of loss when all the air goes out of him.
Yeah, yeah, boy, beautifully said.
I know.
Sad for Hoffman, but beautifully said.
Yeah, yeah. And that might, you know, I think that's very similar to what we were saying with Dustin Hoffman. Two Hoffmans. We have two Hoffmans.
Two Hoffmans in one.
With Dustin Hoffman having such larger than life explosive, like, you're going to go get him. And then when he realizes it's not working out, it's just kind of pouty.
Right. You almost have to take both of those performances and put them in one.
Yeah, right. Right. Yeah.
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 I love a terminal uncertainty. That's such a great
terminal
phrase.
Uncertainty.
Yeah. But that, right. I think, I would pull that. I would pull the quote of what he says about having to see the Titan to the law. I mean, I would pull that and go, okay, if I'm ever directing Death of a Salesman, here it is. This is what you, this is what you need to do. This is what has to happen for Willie Loman.
Right. Right. I mean, if you don't have that, it is kind of a whiny, poor me situation. And then when he goes off to do what he does at the end, you're like, yeah, okay. Those true tragedies, when Oedipus wanders off to the woods after blinding himself, you're just like, man, you could have seen this coming a while ago, bud. Yeah, I feel bad for you. You know, this Willie, you're just like, you really didn't see this coming. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't feel bad.
That denial and that delusion.
Yeah,
that's a great. A great written review.
Oh, I love Ben Brantley stuff. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay, here's our last one. I'm going to send you the picture before I tell you who it is. Here we go.
Oh, great! I don't remember the actor's name, but great.
Wendell Pierce.
Wendell Pierce.
And this is 2022. Wendell Pierce, you might not know when I say that name, but many may remember him from The Wire as Bunk, Dominic West's partner. Dominic West is McNulty and his partner's Bunk. Yeah. And he's been in on a lot of things.
Oh, he's been in lots of things.
Yeah. And he's been in the business side of theater for a long time. But I think, you know, obviously we're talking around it. You and I can see the picture. But the thing that we're talking about here is this is the first Black Willie Loman on Broadway.
Yeah, fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this played on the West End in 2020.
Mm. Where did it play in the West End?
I think at the Piccadilly. It was at a smaller thing and then moved to the Piccadilly. And because people loved it there, they brought it to the States in 2022, which I think is very interesting. And they set it still in the 1940s. But I mean, all of them have been.
Yeah.
But now we're taking it from the Black perspective in the 1940s. Ooh. In the reviews I read, the wariness of the world seems to be on Willie, but he seems to be resilient most of the time. Here's a quote. "This electrically alert and eager Willie nearly always stands ramrod tall in this production, though you sense it's an effort. This is partly because Willie is 60, working in a Darwinian business that belongs to the young and fit. But in this version, he has another heavier handicap. Willie is a Black man in a nation where white is the color of success." That's so heavy.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the rest of this. "While he has absorbed and abides by the mythology and rules of the American dream of self-advancement, there's a part of Willie that worries the odds are fatally stacked against him. The adrenaline that courses through Pierce's performance never lets up. It's no wonder that this overcharged defense system is finally starting to short circuit." Whew.
Yeah. I'd be curious to how Biff is the one who is disillusioned, right? Or is it Happy?
Yeah. Happy loves his life. Happy is all about chasing women and doing the bare minimum to get by. He's fine.
But it'd be, I mean, because you would have all of this undertone, with Biff of just like, how can you not see that the system is stacked against you?
Yeah.
No, I'm going to play the game. Anybody can do it. No, not anybody can do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard enough, here, but we're adding a whole level of race in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the disillusion or what you have to do to keep, I'm going to keep playing by the rules. I'm going to keep doing the thing. I'm going to keep by when the rules don't favor you ever.
Yeah. And there's a couple things about that. Biff, I think in the original production was a high school football star.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. You could probably keep that in line for a Black family. I think in Fences, very famously, same situation, like family in the 40s and the kid wants to play football or something like that. But think about that, where you have a young Black athlete who then realizes that the world is kind of stacked against you. I haven't been part of this discussion for a while, but there used to be that old adage that the only way a Black kid can get ahead in this world is to be a rap star or be an athlete.
Right.
And you're like, that sucks.
Horrible. Well, I think it's interesting too, to do this in 2022.
Yes. That's the other thing I was going to say.
Everything, Black Lives Matter, everything going on, to go, we're going to take the quintessential American, white American play.
Mm-hmm.
And bring a whole new light to it. Of going, yeah, there's a whole other level here that you don't even know about.
Oh man, and the script remained pretty much unchanged. I mean,
it's just just the interpretation. Yeah,
yeah. I think they may have put back in the walrus stuff because Wendell Pierce is kind of a big guy, and I think he played him. I think he was 51, but. Tracy, there was this glorious little story about an interviewer sat down to meet him for a lunch when they were just going to, that's how they were going to do their interview. And in the middle of the thing, he actually starts just quoting the play. And I can't remember the lines, but it's just like, how can a man face all of this stuff against him and still think he's going to come out on top?
Mm-hmm.
And Pierce actually started crying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, he's feeling this so hard. And I'm like, that's the person to play this because he gets it. He gets it. He gets it so hard.
More than any of the other actors.
Right. Right. And especially at the times, like, you know, 99, well, we were fine. You know, I mean, we had just come off the Clinton White House and there was actually a surplus in the budget and things were okay. Sure, there were bombings happening and, you know, people were losing their minds over somebody having some sexual activity in the Oval Office. But I mean, you know, to question the American dream at those points, you're like, well, I mean, it's worth doing. But here you've got this whole situation with Black Lives Matter, utter strange denial of that. And then you still have people going, no, we're still being kind of oppressed. And it's not.
How much backwards? I mean, just so much. I mean, that goes to, there's so many things that we just keep going backwards to what the Make America Great Again people want is back to 1949.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah. And so if you're, hey, if that's a time when America was great, just ask Willie Loman.
There you go.
Full circle.
That's your end.
Yep. That's my story about Willie Loman on Broadway. And I think they all got nominated for Tonys. Some of them got the Tony. And whether or not you put value in those awards or not, you got to go. But this has been done 6 times on Broadway.
Yeah.
So there has been like a need. And, you know, I think about it like you were saying earlier, it is kind of unfortunate that it is very male centric. But I think we are kind of getting away from that in a way.
In what way?
Well, like
maybe in theater, maybe you're seeing more.
Yeah.
Theater.
Yeah. I would say that. I mean, you've got Nicole Scherzinger who just did Sunset Boulevard in London and everybody's like, wait, the girl from the Pussycat Dolls is doing a really great, brilliant Sunset Boulevard. Let's see that over in America. And so that's coming up in the next theater season. But it's actually very interesting because post COVID, doing the show, I've been kind of following the market and seeing what trends are sticking and what is not, and just trying to get people back in the theater and see stuff. And, you know, revivals are always kind of a way to do that because you can always say, here's Benedict Cumberbatch's Hamlet, or here's Crims Hemsworth playing Petruchio. You know, it'll be cute and get people there. But what is it saying overall? Is it really forwarding things, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it's kind of, they're getting there.
Well, that's why something like Wendell Pierce playing Willie Loman, that is what I'm talking about. Like, what would it be for modern? You know, that's exactly the question I had at the beginning. And it's like, it got answered. You do it with a cast that isn't white. And you look at the perspective with the same material, just through the lens of a Black family.
Yeah.
And that gives it a whole other meaning, and with an actor who can really relate to the circumstances.
Oh yeah.
Simply because of his color.
That makes me think of the complete outcry when national casting calls went out for tours of Hamilton. And they're like, we would just like people of color to try out for the first little bit of it. We might bring some white actors in, but that's what we would like. Because that's the point of that show.
Right,
it's
right.
Like, we're all American. This is all our history. And so we can all play it. And you just had a lot of people go, but George Washington was white. You're like, that's correct. But the idea of George Washington doesn't always have to be white. That cracked me up when people got upset over that.
Well, they get upset about everything.
Yeah.
That isn't white. Black Little Mermaid, whatever, you know, like black, that what is your problem?
That Mulan is too Asian.
Are you so insecure that you cannot handle? Do you need all the power? All of it. I want all of it.
All of it.
There's no room for anybody else to have any of it. I need all of it. Mm-hmm. And even if I can't see you, and I don't even know you, I want to make sure I dictate your life and who you can love and what you can do, and et cetera, et cetera. Even though it has nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
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 It's absolutely obscene. Vote in November.
But in November, well, you know, perhaps that's why we still do productions of Death of a Salesman, so we can show that that whole idea ain't working for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. Anything that can go, you know, the whole American dream thing, this whole individualism, rugged individualism, it's not where it's at.
Not fantastic. You know, Tracy and I played with the idea that I may have been interested in this topic, as I can see myself playing Willie Loman at some point in the future. As we discussed, apparently, I don't have to be age-appropriate to play him. But I think I would prefer that as an actor. At 44, I just haven't lived as long or struggled as long as Willie has. That's just my preference, but I suppose some great makeup could be applied. I want to thank Tracy Burns as my guest on these last two episodes. Couldn't have done it without her. I'm sure to have her back for another installment in the future. But for now, I'll sign off. This has been another episode of Euripides Humanities, a theater history podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Odom. Another episode will be in your ears in 2 weeks. I'll see you at intermission.